the things that I found recently was some information about self-esteem. And I found this self-esteem scale, which goes from 10 down to 1, 10 being where you would see yourself or judge yourself as having total self-esteem, where you believe in yourself and you value yourself. And then it goes through down to the numbers, into good self-esteem, to neutral self-esteem, to low self-esteem, to rock bottom self-esteem, where its description is where you are unable to function in society because of the way that you view yourself. I wonder, this is a rhetorical question, I wonder where you would put yourself on that scale. And we have to be realistic in knowing that maybe you would have given yourself one number yesterday and you might give yourself a different number today. I know that in myself, it depends on the situation as to how much self-esteem I have. So I know that as soon as I get into the car and I switch the engine on, I have incredibly high self-esteem. Because I, like many men, believe that I'm one of the best drivers in the world and that if I wanted to, I could probably do Formula One. But I'm too tall. I'm too tall to be a Formula One driver. But I know that in other circumstances, like when I go onto a football pitch, I know that I have probably rock bottom self-esteem because I'm unable to function properly when I get the football at my feet. But over the last few decades, there has been an increasing focus on self and how we see ourselves. We focus on our self-esteem. We focus on self-help. We focus on self-improvement. I can remember 10, 15 years ago, there were all of these different self-help books coming out, which were, it gave you all of these practical tips on how to view yourself. If you viewed yourself as a pawn, you could end up viewing yourself as a king. That time seems to have passed a little, but still, everywhere you look, there is article after article of how to improve yourself, improve your life. And so esteem, whether it's high or whether it's low or whether it's in the middle, seems to have quite a big impact on our lives, but also on the ways in which we behave. The way that we view ourselves and our esteem over the centuries has also been a reason to fear or to celebrate certain people as well. So up until the 20th century, the general view was that those who were violent, those who were abusive, those who committed crime, would be seen as people who had very high self-esteem. People who thought very much of themselves and thought very little of others. Therefore, through education, through the prison system, through society as a whole, the idea was try to bring these people down a peg or two in their view of themselves. That in some way their high self-esteem had to be broken so that they could come back down to a normal level so that they would function better in society. But since the 20th century, there's been a complete flip in that understanding, where those who are abusive, those who are violent, those who commit crime, and are often regarded as people who deep down probably have low self-esteem. People who do think very little of themselves and therefore act out in ways of frustration or in terms of desperation or sometimes even in terms of validation as well. And so we could just take the example of a playground bully, of how for centuries gone by, we would have viewed them as people with too high self-esteem, but that in today's society, we would see them as people of low self-esteem. So rather than us trying to bring them down, we want to be trying to build them up. Now, sociologists and psychologists debate whether which of these two ideas is actually the correct one, but I assume it's a lot more palatable to be trying to build people up rather than be knocking people down in this society. And that is probably one of the reasons why we focus on people having low self-esteem rather than high. But whether we have high or low self-esteem, it is good for us to sometimes have some self-focus, for us to have some kind of self-awareness. We want to be people who are healthy. We want to be people who are helpful. We want to be people who function well in society. And therefore, it does require us to have some sort of introspection and to be looking at ourselves. But at the same time, it can go a bit too far. In our society, through media, through social media, through the education system, through many different parts and walks of life, we are encouraged to be focusing more and more on self. And although to an extent that is good, it can also become incredibly tiring when we're always looking in the mirror, thinking about how we might improve, or thinking about our faults. So often it can become stressful when we start thinking about ourselves and our own inadequacies and what we should be working on. It's tiring, it's stressful, but also it gets to a point where it's incredibly boring as well. Not only for yourself, but for others, if you're always talking about yourself. So today, we are going to be discovering how self, although it can be a good thing in some ways, always thinking about self can be a baggage which stops us from following Jesus. And so to do that, we're going to be looking at Mark's Gospel, chapter 10, and James is going to come and read to us.
Yeah, so Mark 10, verses 32 to 45. They were now on the way up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. The disciples were filled with awe, and the people following behind were overwhelmed with fear. Taking the 12 disciples aside, Jesus once more began to describe everything that was about to happen to him. "Listen," he said, "we're going up to Jerusalem, where the Son of Man will be betrayed to the leading priests and the teachers of religious law. They will sentence him to die and hand him over to the Romans. They will mock him, spit on him, flog him and flog him with a whip and kill him. But after 3 days he will rise again." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came over and spoke to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do us a favor." "What is your request?" he asked. They replied, "When you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left." But Jesus said to them, "You don't know what you are asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering I am about to drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism of suffering I must be baptized with?" "Oh yes," they replied, "we are able." Then Jesus told them, "You will indeed drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering, but I have no right to say who will sit on my right or my left. God has prepared those places for the ones he has chosen." When the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant. So Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many."
Thanks, James. And so we see Jesus and his friends on their way to Jerusalem, a final journey in Jesus' ministry on earth. He's made it quite clear and apparent to those around him that this is going to be his final journey. He's on his way to Jerusalem, and he won't be coming out of it. Time is clearly very short, and so it's a time when the disciples might be thinking about their final words that they want to be saying to Jesus, or indeed what their final requests might be. And so in this instance, we see James and we see John, two brothers, getting their question in, getting their request in to Jesus. And we don't read it in Mark's gospel, but an interesting detail in Matthew's gospel is that James and John also have their mother, Salome, with them as well. And so maybe you think in some ways they're a bit shy, they're a bit hesitant in asking for a favour, and so they get their mum to come along and to help them with it. So we have James and we have John. Because James is normally mentioned first in the Gospels, we assume that James is the older of the two brothers. And they are the sons of Salome and of Zebedee. And Zebedee is described in the Gospels as a fisherman with a number of boats. This would have been fairly unusual at that time, as most fishermen would have just had one boat. And so therefore, we can say that he was a successful businessman. At the same time, there's another reference which says that he sometimes had the company of the chief high priest as well. So we know that Zebedee is a successful man, and he is an influential man. And his sons, James and John, form part of an inner circle of friends with Jesus. So we have James and we have John and we have Peter, who are three people who are sometimes banded together in certain references to what Jesus gets up to. So as we look further back into Mark, we see the story of the Transfiguration, the time where Jesus appears in glory and in brightness and in light with Moses on one side, with Elijah on the other, and they do it in front of just three people, this inner circle of James, John, and Peter. Later on in the story, in the coming days, we'll see Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he wants the protection and he wants the help of three individuals, even though there are others there. And he wants the help and the attention of James, of John, and of Peter. So James and John maybe have a rich heritage from their family. Maybe they've been brought up with a good lifestyle. Maybe they've had the rich and the famous coming to their home, and they've been able to know them. Maybe they have certain privileges in their lives, and certainly by being part of this inner circle that Jesus has with them, perhaps they think that after all of this time of sacrifice, of giving up perhaps the riches and the privileges that they had previously enjoyed, perhaps during this time of serving with Jesus, now the time is coming towards an end of Jesus' earthly ministry. Now is the time to ask for a favor. Now is the time to ask for a reward. And so they say, "Teacher, we want you to do us a favor." They're essentially asking Jesus to write a blank check, aren't they? Because they're not saying exactly what they want, but they're hoping that Jesus, in all of his love and in his grace and in his mercy, will say, "Yes, whatever you ask, I will give to you." But Jesus' response is, "What is your request?" And it's funny, isn't it, really? Because I think all of us have been in these situations so many times before when someone comes up to us and says, "I need your help with something." You never ever say, yes, whatever it is, I will do for you, do you? You say, what is it? And Jesus does the same thing. But at the same time, this isn't just, okay, James and John, I'm not exactly sure what you're going to be asking for, therefore I want to know a little bit more. But he's asking a really deep question just in these four words. What is your request? Time is coming towards an end. Their time with Jesus is coming towards an end. We don't know what the future holds. You've got one request to make. What is it? What do you really want? What is the one thing that you truly desire that I might be able to do for you? It's a good question that maybe Jesus is asking of us as well. That we have, you know, our five-finger prayers, and we can be praying through all sorts of things, and we can be asking for all sorts of things. But if there's just one thing that you could request of Jesus, what would it be? And I'd suggest that whatever it truly is really does reveal what your heart is after. And so James and John make this request. When you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left. This request comes straight after Jesus has said these words to them. Listen, he said, we're going up to Jerusalem, where the Son of Man will be betrayed to the leading priests and the teachers of the religious law. They will sentence him to die and hand him over to the Romans. They will mock him, spit on him, flog him with a whip, and kill him. But after 3 days, he will rise again. Jesus has just painted a picture of what the coming days will be for him. These dreadful events that will happen to Jesus. And straight afterwards, rather than trying to console him or ask more about what's going to be happening, James and John come with this selfish request. Their focus is on themselves. They've heard, and perhaps they've accepted, that Jesus will be suffering. But they trust that he will, at the end of all of that, he'll have some kind of eventual triumph, whether that be overtaking the authorities in Jerusalem, whether it be becoming the king of the Jewish nation, whether it be overthrowing the whole of the Roman Empire, or maybe something with a bit more of an end time kind of thought to it. They don't really know, but they know that he's going to triumph in the end, and they want to have a piece of it. And they've got really no interest in what Jesus is going to have to go through before that. As I said before, they'd just recently witnessed the transfiguration. They'd seen Jesus in all of his glory with Moses on one side of him and Elijah on the other. Perhaps they were thinking, Jesus is going to be glorified again, but I want to take Moses' place. Or maybe I deserve to take Elijah's place on the left and on the right side of Jesus. Or perhaps they would have been familiar with some Jewish teaching which we can find in the Talmud. The Talmud says this: of three walking along, the teacher should walk in the middle, the greater of his disciples to his right, the smaller one at his left. And thus we do find that of the three angels who came to visit Abraham, Michael went in the middle, Gabriel at his right, Raphael at his left. Maybe they've got these different pictures and thoughts in their minds of Jesus. Yes, he is at the center, but I want to have a really good sweet spot and a good seat, either on his left or on his right. And so they are obviously imagining themselves in very lofty positions. But Jesus reveals what their reality and what their future will actually hold. It won't be about Jesus, yeah, getting on with the road to Calvary's cross and then having this triumph. But Jesus wants them to focus on the journey that they are soon going to be going on themselves, a difficult one. He points out and he says quite clearly that they're not going to have an easy path to this point of glory, but rather they're going to find much trouble and persecution. And as we read through the rest of the New Testament, we do see that being the case. So James, the older of the two brothers, is mentioned at the beginning of Acts 12 in just a couple of verses where it's described how he was persecuted and how he was put to death. And he was, in fact, the first of the disciples to have lost their lives because of their faith. And then we then see in the book of Acts, but also through church history, that 50 years later, it is the Apostle John, after so much persecution, who then ends his days, likely in exile, on the island of Patmos. Possibly he died in Ephesus, but it was a long life of hardship and of isolation and of persecution. And so these two brothers who were hoping to skip past all of this trouble and just be at this wonderful point of glory actually find a life of suffering and of hardship. And they end up being kind of the two bookends of the first followers of Jesus, James being the first to lose his life and John being the one to live the longest, but to end that time of the apostles. The disciples overhear what James and John are saying, and they are indignant, they are furious, they are mad with the request that has been made to Jesus. First of all, it's just clearly a really selfish request after what Jesus has just said. For them just to be thinking about their own place is a dreadful thing. The second thing is that it's neglectful of them. They've come to Jesus with their mum, asking for these two great seats next to Jesus. They haven't asked about these other disciples that they've lived with and eaten with and suffered with for the last 3 years. They've completely forgotten them. So they've been selfish, they've been neglectful of the others. But also, thirdly, perhaps there was part of them that wanted the same. That these seats that had been asked for, they actually wanted these seats for themselves. It's just they hadn't been able to pluck up the courage to ask for it yet. The disciples are falling out. Jesus huddles them together and gives them this reality that actually in the world, leaders are self-seeking, and quite often it works out well for them. They seek to make much of themselves to get to the top, and quite often it does work out that way. But the kingdom is different from the world. In the kingdom, it's leaders who aren't self-seeking, but seek to serve others. And then Jesus, as he describes himself as the Son of Man, demonstrates how he is our pioneer, and he is our model and our example. Because even though he was the one with all power and all authority over all of the earth and everything in it, he thought little of himself, and he made little of himself to make much of others. James and John must have been humbled when they realized how ridiculous they were in their request. That they had been holding on, perhaps, with their mum for this really petty self-ambition for a place with Jesus in glory. But then they understand the bigger context of what Jesus is about to do on his path of suffering and on his path of redemption. We have our own times, don't we, when we perhaps realize how ridiculous we are in our own thoughts and in our own self-absorption. Those times when we are navel-gazing, when we don't realize what is going on around us. The times, maybe the hours and the so many occasions when we are looking into ourselves, or we're looking into a mirror, and we're so focused on what we look like and what we wish we looked like and what we might be able to do so that we look better. Those times in which we spend maybe hours at the shop trying to pick out the perfect shirt or the perfect dress in the thought that somehow it is going to make us more valuable and more popular as people. The times and the hours that we might be thinking about how popular we might be or how unpopular we might be, and different ways, very little ways in which we can try to improve that. The times in which we are navel-gazing and we're so consumed with ourselves, we're so consumed with bettering ourselves and putting ourselves in a better position that we forget the bigger context and the troubles of our world. 5 or 6 years ago, I went to Africa for the first time, and I went to Ghana to help with a charity out there. And within a day or two of being there, my mind, the way that my mind works and my priorities and my navel gazing really changed. Because for all of those times where I'd been thinking about how I looked or about how I dressed, all those times that I'd been wishing that I'd had a better job or more money or a better car or a better holiday or whatever like that, you see what the rest of the world is like and you are humbled and you realize that it doesn't matter how many nice shirts I own when you're meeting people who wear the same clothes day in, day out, that it doesn't really matter whether what restaurant you go to when there are so many people in the world who are hungry, or what your house looks like when you go to people's situations and find them homeless and living way below the poverty line. It is good for us at different times for us to take ourselves out of ourselves and to be seeing the bigger picture. And to be honest, with the way that I think about myself sometimes, the amount that I think about myself sometimes, maybe I need to be taking another trip fairly soon. In the same way, there are times when we focus so much on ourselves in a spiritual sense that we're completely unaware of what is going around us. The amount of time that we think about our own personal spiritual growth, our own preferences, the songs that we do like to sing, but also the songs that we don't like to sing. The bits of the Bible that we do like to read, but the bits of the Bible that we don't. The times that we choose to come to church because it seems good, and then other times that we don't. The way that we like to have the building or certain parts of the building laid out. All of these things of our own preferences, our own wants, our own desires can be so inward-looking, so self-seeking, when really, if we thought about it just for a second, we'd realize that there are much bigger powers at play in our world that we should be investing our time in. That there is so much, that there is a battle between injustice and justice. There is a battle going on in our world between good and evil. There is a battle going on in our world between light and darkness. There is a battle going on in our world between angels and demons. There is a battle going on in our world between heaven and hell. And we live in a time and in a place where we are more aware than ever of the situation of our world, the situation of the kingdom and the struggles of the kingdom, and how we should be investing our prayers, how we should be investing our time, how we should be investing our thoughts and our concerns on these big global things which Jesus is seeking to solve, rather than our own petty little thoughts and preferences. So in order to keep up with Jesus, to be where he is at, to be concerned with what he is concerned with, we should not be thinking too much of ourselves. Just like James and John, there are times when we see ourselves as little emperors of our own little empires, and we want to be building them up as much as we possibly can to be making the best life that we can have for ourselves. We can be thinking about the choices that we make for our family so that we have the best family. We can be thinking about what improvements we want to be making to our house so that we can be living in the best house that we can. We can be thinking about which church we want to be attending so that we can have the best spiritual experience that we can. We can end up being emperors of our own little empires rather than being servants of the king. The second mistake is to be thinking too little of ourselves. That sometimes we think that if we are humble and if we think, oh yes, we are great sinners and we can't do anything right, that somehow there's some kind of holiness in that humility. When really there isn't, because still there's that self-absorption in who we are and what we think of ourselves. Let's not think too much of ourselves. Let's not think too little of ourselves. But instead, let's think of ourselves little. I love the prayer time that we had earlier on because the fifth and the final thing that we prayed for was for me, was for ourselves. That through all of these different things that we're praying for, it's only the little pinky which is given over to praying and thinking about ourselves. That's the way it should be because we should be more concerned about the other things that are going on rather than just self. If we truly want to follow Jesus, we need to be thinking less about looking down at the ground and looking at our own feet, but we should be rather looking forward and seeing where Jesus' feet are heading. Because we can spend our whole lives looking at our feet and seeing where we're going, and Jesus could be racing ahead, or he could be going in a completely different direction. Let's look less at ourselves. Let's think of ourselves little and focus more on Jesus' steps. In different ways, we are all encouraged to be thinking about ourself, our ego, our pride, and sometimes our insecurity as well. All of those things can be baggage for us. May we choose to drop the baggage of self so that we can focus on Jesus and that so that we can follow him closely. Amen. Let's take a moment just in the quiet just to be thinking and to be reflecting on our passage this morning, and then we will stand to sing.